Revelation chapter 3, verse 7. Revelation chapter 3, verse 7. To the angel of the church in Philadelphia, write, "These are the words of him who is holy and true, who holds the key of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. I know your deeds. See, I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut. I know that you have little strength, yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. I will make those who are the synagogue of Satan, who claim to be Jews, though they are not, but are liars, I will make them come and fall down at your feet and acknowledge that I have loved you. Since you have kept my command to endure patiently, I will also keep you from the hour of trial that is going to come upon the whole world to test those who live on the earth. I am coming soon. Hold on to what you have, so that no one will take your crown. Him who overcomes, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God. Never again will he leave it. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which is coming down out of heaven from my God. And I will also write on him my new name. He who has ears, has an ear, let him hear. He who has an ear, let him hear what the church says to the churches, what the Spirit says to the churches." We come to number 6 of 7. The book of Revelation opens with a picture of Jesus in chapter 1 that we cannot escape, we cannot skip over. We need to dwell there for a while. And then chapter 2 and chapter 3 gives us 7 letters that Jesus has John record and pass on to 7 churches in Asia Minor. And this morning we come to number 6. We come to the church that was gathered in the city of Philadelphia. Now we know the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It gets its name from this city. This city was not originally called Philadelphia. It was another name that I can't even pronounce and I won't try to. But it was given the name of Philadelphia in the 2nd century B.C. by the king whose name was Eumenes II. He was a king of the Lydian Empire. And he gave this city the name Pergamum, or in his language it was Greek, Pergamos, because of his younger brother. His younger brother, who was going to be his successor, would take over when this king died, had shown himself to be so loyal and so devoted to his older brother that he was given the nickname Philadelphia. Did I say Pergamos? Sorry, that was the other city. Say it with me. Philadelphos. Thank you. Which means love of your brother. The city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, is known as the city of brotherly love. That's what it means. And so he named this city after his brother's nickname, because of his brother's loyalty to him, his brother's love for him. We know that this city was on the royal highway, or the post, they called it, that went from Rome to the Far East. And so it was an influential city. We also know that in 17 BC, it was totally destroyed by a massive earthquake that destroyed Sardis and about 10 other cities in the area. It's right on a fault line. It has a different name today in Turkey. I won't try to pronounce that name either. The city is still there, parts of it, but it's just known as, by a different name. It was called Little Athens because there were so many Greek temples in this city that it was like a Greek culture. They spoke Greek there. Again, it was on this fault line that where these earthquakes had happened. And I want you to remember that, because that's going to come back, I think, a little bit later on. We'll have some significance as we move through our study this morning. And so beyond that, we don't know a whole lot about the city. It wasn't a large city. It was a significant city. And right away, as he begins this letter, after he identifies where it's going to go, he gives us a picture of himself, which he does in every one of these 7 letters. "These are the words of him who is holy and true, who holds the key of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. These are the words of him who is holy and true." Holy meaning without blemish, without impurity, without spot. Who is this referring to? It's Jesus, right? It's taking us back to chapter 1. Jesus is the one that is writing these letters. In fact, the book of Revelation is the only book in the Bible that's directly penned by Jesus. He tells John exactly what to write down. John is just a scribe. He's just a recorder. And that is significant, not that the rest of the Bible is any less significant, because it's inspired by God through the Holy Spirit who led the various men to write down these words so that we could have them today and we would know who God is and what his will is. But it is significant that in the book of Revelation, it's Jesus himself saying, this is what I want you to write. And so as he begins this letter to the church at Philadelphia, he says, I'm the one who is holy and I'm the one who is true. I am holy. There is no blemish in me. There is no impurity. I'm perfect. I'm without failure, without sin. And he says, I am true. The best way to describe this word true is this. What you see is what you get. Literally means the name and the nature match. Ford used to have a slogan. Quality is job one. Hey, it was an effective slogan. Quality is job one. Now that's the claim. That's the name. Those of you that are Chevy lovers, you refer to Ford as what? F-O-R-D. Oh, see? Yeah, found on road. Those of us that love Fords, we say F-O-R-D is? No. You're a Chevy lover. Yeah, fix or repair daily. First on race day. Yeah, exactly. So the claim, the name. Now, that's fine. We can argue that all we want. But when you buy the car and you drive it, is the nature of the car, the quality of the car, does it match, in fact, the name? This word here, true, means it's true. What it claims and what it is are the same. The name and the nature are the same. God says with me, what you get, what you see is what you get. I am true. What I claim, the promises I make, the way that I reveal myself, I will be that. And I will always be that. You can count on that. These are the words of him who is holy and true, who holds the key of David. This is kind of an interesting picture. He's quoting from Isaiah chapter 22, verse 22. So if you're a history or an Old Testament geek, write that in your notes. Isaiah chapter 22, verse 22. There was a guy named Eliakim. Let me make sure I say his name right. Eliakim. In this book of prophecy, God reveals that Sheba, who was the treasurer of King Hezekiah, based on his character, based on his choices, he was not a reliable man. He was not a godly man. And he was going to be replaced by Eliakim. These two guys were the treasurers. Well, the first one was the treasurer. He was going to be replaced. Eliakim was going to be given, says in Isaiah 22:22, it would be attached to his shoulder right here. He'd wear the key of David. And what that key was, it was the key to the treasury of King Hezekiah. He had the lockbox. He had the key that decided who got money and who didn't. Now, the king could tell him what to do, but it still had to go through him. He had the final say, the authority of dispersing the resources, giving out the money, locking the door, or opening the door. And Jesus quotes that picture, which we might refer to as a type. Eliakim was a type of Christ. He was given the authority of the resources of the earthly kingdom of Israel. Jesus says, I'm the one, I have the key to the eternal kingdom, the kingdom. He says, I have the key of David. I have the authority. And he goes on to explain it by saying, what he, that is this one, these words of him, Jesus, what he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. It's just a picture of authority. It's a picture of final authority. I do have a kit. I have a house key. What does that signify? That I have the authority, I have the right. Matt said ownership. I would like to agree with him, but it should say, Chase Home Financial across the key, because technically they have ownership. But I like to live in the fantasy world that I own a house. Ownership, authority. I can go into the house and then I can lock the door and I can choose not to let you in, because I open the door. And I lock the door because it's, quote, my house. In my office on my desk, there's a key to my car. I have the authority to get in that car, start that car, drive that car, and lock the car. I have the authority to say, you can drive my car or you can't drive my car, because I hold the key. That's all this is a picture of Jesus saying, I have the authority. I have access to all the resources. I have access to the kingdom. And I decide what happens with those resources and with those opportunities. Let me apologize. I'm fighting. I'm getting sick. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice. And I'm trying not to gross you up by, you know, without thinking, just sucking up what wants to come out. But if I don't do it, then it kind of hovers right back here, and then you feel that ball form right back there, and then you have to swallow. And I took some medicine just before I came up here, so just be forewarned. Just I'm trying to not gross anybody out, but I'm not going crazy. I'm just trying to be discreet with my mucus. How's that? Is that good? We need to edit the recording. He holds the keys. If we go back to chapter 1, here's what he says in chapter 1, because each of these openings of these letters has a reference back to the picture in chapter 1. Anybody remember what he says in chapter 1? Go back to chapter 1, verse, what is it, 18 or somewhere around, yeah, verse 1, 18, chapter 1, verse 18. He says, I hold the keys to death and the grave, to death and Hades. Wow, there's a real picture of authority. Jesus says, I'm the one that decides who goes to heaven and who doesn't. I'm the one that decides who spends eternity with God and who doesn't. Who spends eternity here or there. I'm the one that's going to separate the sheep from the goats. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Now that's a little hard for me to stand up here and say that to a group of people or say it into our culture, because it sounds very judgmental, it sounds very narrow. I'm not saying this. I'm not making this up. You can agree, you can disagree, you can believe it or you can reject it. You're not rejecting me. Okay? You're not rejecting me as a person standing up here. We're rejecting Jesus Christ. Either he is who he says he is, and he made those claims and we have to deal with it, or he's not. Every single human being on the planet will stand before their Creator one day and give an account as to what we did with that. Jesus says, I hold the keys. I hold the keys to death and to Hades. I hold all the keys. I have the authority. You come to God through me. Now, that sounds narrow and tough. Okay, I'll give you that. But here's the good news. Jesus says, you can come to me, and through me, you can have a relationship with God. You can be forgiven. I was willing to die on the cross and give my life for you because I want you to come to God. I want you to be forgiven. I want you to spend eternity in heaven with me. I don't want you to spend eternity in hell. But I won't apologize. I'm speaking for him. I won't apologize and I won't back down from the claim that there's only one way to have a relationship with God. And Jesus says, that's through me. I hold the keys. So he sets up this letter with this picture of authority. I'm holy. I'm true. I hold the key of David. He holds the keys of hell, death, and the grave. And what I open or what I shut, no one can undo. And then in verse 8, he says this, I know your deeds. This letter is a letter to, as Matt pointed out, it's a letter to a church who did it right. There's no condemnation in this letter. There's no correction. There's no, you're doing a good job, however, I got this against you. We've heard that, right? There is none of that. But here's what's interesting to me as I studied this week. Sometimes medication makes your tongue not work. This letter written to a church that was doing it right, you know where the focus is? The focus is on Jesus. The focus is on him and his relationship with them and his love for them. I titled this message a love story. We could write it a love letter. I honestly was going through my files this week cleaning up stuff, and I collected a big pile of letters, notes that my wife had written to me over the years. And I contemplated bringing them this morning. The only reason I didn't is because I wasn't going to read them to you. I was just going to have them bundled up here with a rubber band, but I thought if they fall into the wrong hands, you know, that just, you know, could really be used against me and Becky. So, yeah, so I didn't bring them, but I read through a lot of those this week. And in the evenings when I was going through stuff, I'm reading these letters and I kept thinking, that's what this is. This is a love letter. This is a love story between a groom and a bride. We're told in Revelation chapter 19 and Revelation 21 and even in 22 and I think Revelation 17, the picture of the church is a bride. There's going to be a wedding. There's going to be a feast. There's a really cool picture in, I believe it's Revelation 21, where it says the Spirit and the Bride say, come. Come drink of the water. Come find life. There's a picture of us standing next to our Savior, standing with God, and joining Him in, come on, calling to people to come to God and to partake of who He is and what He's offering. It truly is a picture of the church, those who've chosen to put their faith in Jesus Christ, His family, His body. We're called His bride. And in this letter to this church in Philadelphia, it's a love letter. And the emphasis is on Him and what He's going to do for them. So first of all, He says, I know your deeds. And I've got some points there on your notes. Some ones I want to make sure that we don't miss out. And the first one is, I know. I know. What does He know? He says, I know your deeds. I know your life. I know your actions. I know your choices. I know how you're living. I'm aware. Now that in and of itself is significant. I have learned as a husband of 27 plus years that it's so important to invest time in really knowing my wife. Now she's home, she's sick. She's homesick today, so I can talk about her and not face repercussions. As long as we all agree not to say anything. We need to have a pact, okay? Everybody, raise your right hand, repeat after me. No. It's really important for me to know her. And there's no way for me to know her except I invest time in just being with her and listening to her and valuing her. Right, gentlemen? There's no shortcuts to that. Right, ladies? That's what we need to do. We need to invest time in just listening and being with you and observing to know you, to be involved in your life. That's all encumbered, or it's all included in this picture of Him saying, I know. I know what you're doing. I know the life that you're living. I know what's happening in your life. See, I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut. We'll come back to that. I know that you have a little strength. Now, the phrase here, little strength, isn't a reference to, you know, hi, I'm Kurt, you know, I'm not really strong, but I have a little bit of strength, you know, so it's not an individual thing with a person. It's a reference to their collective strength, most likely their number. What I believe He's saying here is that you're just a small group of people. I know that you just have a little bit of strength. It's not that you have a ton of resources and a lot of numbers and a lot of stuff to kind of get the job done. You're just a small group of faithful people. I know that you have a little strength, and yet you have kept my word. You've obeyed. You've done what I've asked you to do. And you have not denied my name. You've not denied my name. You've not denied, you've not been willing to step away from, I'm a follower of Jesus Christ. Now where are they doing this? They're doing this in a city that's called Little Athens. It's dominated by temples to what we studied in school as Greek mythology. Remember that? Zeus, Apollos, Hermes, Achilles, you know, and we've had movies in the theaters that have come out that have kind of, you know, kind of taken us back to that whole Greek mythology. Those temples really existed, and there were people that really worshipped and believed those were true living things that were controlling the world. And they had temples that they worshipped them in, all around in the city. And He says, I know that in that place, in spite of what your culture around you is like, you've been unwilling to deny that you belong to me. When people say, I worship Apollos, or I worship Zeus, or I worship the NFL, or I worship, you know, cars, or I worship money, or I worship... You just keep telling people that you worship Jesus Christ, and you're a follower of Jesus Christ. He said, I know that. I know that you have little strength, and yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. He knows. In the letters that I have written to my wife and the ones that I looked at this week, there's a lot of that in those love letters. The I know stuff. Many of my letters will say, I know I'm not the easiest guy to live with. I know that, and then I'll talk about me. And then I will communicate to her, but you are, and then I'll describe something that I love about her, something that I appreciate, something that many of you, maybe all, none of you, know about. Some of them you might, because it's character of hers, her character that's, you know, public. But there's things that I just share with her that I appreciate this and I love this about you. And they're personal, intimate things that I know because of my relationship with her. And that's the picture here of Jesus writing to this church. I know. I'm intimately aware of you, my people, and how you're living for me. And I so appreciate that you're obeying my word. You're doing what I've called you to do. What is that? It's this, right? They didn't have all of this, but we do. He says, you obey it. And you're not ashamed. You're very willing, no matter what the cost, to just be identified with me. I know that. So the first thing that he says to his bride is that I know. The second thing he says is that he will provide. Go back to verse 8. I know your deeds. See, now look, literally behold, check it out. I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut. Now, there's a lot of debate about what this is referring to. I'm just going to give you a couple of verses that are not in your notes, but I want you to write them down. These verses may come up in your life group tonight in the next couple of nights. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 12, Paul is writing to the Corinthian church, and he says, when I came to Troas to preach the gospel, a door was opened unto me of the Lord, or opened to me because of the Lord. Colossians chapter 4, verse 2. Are these in the thing? Okay, so if you open to the middle of your insert, they're already there. Okay, you can circle them. Some of them are. Okay, so check it out. Pay very careful attention. Behold, see if these verses are in there. Colossians chapter 2, verse 4. Paul says to the Colossian church, pray that God would open unto us, Paul and his team of missionaries, that he would open unto us a door of utterance to speak the mystery of Christ, to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then in the book of Acts, chapter 14, verse 27, Paul returns to his sending church in Antioch, and he gives them a report of what God did on his trip. And he says this in verse 27, on arriving there at Antioch, they gathered the church together and reported all that God had done through them and how he had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles. So through the New Testament, Old Testament as well, but particularly the New Testament, this idea of opening a door seems to point to God providing the avenue or the opportunity for his people to live out their faith and be faithful to them, to him. Jesus is providing for this church in Philadelphia, this small church, this small group of people in a really tough culture. He's providing for them. He's allowing them. He's providing the way for them to be obedient and to be faithful. He's supplying what they need. Is that significant? I hope we see the significance of that. That the one who calls me to love him, the one who calls me to follow him, the one who calls me to be obedient to him, the one who calls me to love him and appreciate him, will also provide the way for me to do that. Because he knows, first of all, he knows me, he knows my circumstances, he knows where I'm at, and then he provides. I don't have any excuse based on my circumstances or my life, my past, my lack of opportunity, whatever, or the sinful darkness of my culture. None of that excuses me from living out my love for Jesus Christ, my faith in him. Do you see that? Why is that true? Because my groom, the groom of the church, my Savior, will provide an open door. He will provide a way for me to live out what he's called me to do and to be. And that's what he reminds this church. Maybe they just needed to hear it again. They needed that encouragement. Look, I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut. I know that you have a little strength. We've talked about that. Yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. Verse 9. I will make those who are the synagogue of Satan, who claim to be Jews, though they are not, but liars, I will make them come and fall down at your feet and acknowledge that I have loved you. Number 3, he tells them that I will fight for you. I know, I will provide for you, and I will fight for you. The synagogue of Satan has shown up before in another city. One of the things that I discovered in studying for this series was how predominant the Jewish population was in this part of the world. Particularly after the destruction of the temple in AD 70. The Jews were dispersed. The Romans had it with Judea. The emperor sent his son to go in there and deal with it, and they killed 100,000 Jews. They just had it. They'd had it with rebellion. You remember when Jesus was crucified and Pilate was, the governor at the time. They were really concerned about riots and people gathering because they didn't want that to get back to Rome, because that would reflect negatively on Pilate. Historical records tell us that Pilate lost his job a very short time after Jesus' crucifixion. And governor after governor was sent to rule Judea. Finally, Rome had had it. They literally tore the temple down, every single stone. They didn't leave two stones, fitted stones, touching each other. They destroyed it. And they lined up the Jewish, those who had surrendered the Jewish people, and they slaughtered. They just killed them. They just walked, they lined them up and just took swords and walked down and just started killing them. And the result of that was that the Jews fled. They ran. They left. So would we. Let's not be too hard on them. They dispersed. And by the time this book is written, and in the second and third century, there's a large Jewish population in Asia Minor. It's why when we have World War II and Hitler is trying to destroy the Jews, do you ever wonder, why are there so many Jews in Eastern Europe? Shouldn't they be in Israel? Isn't that where the Jewish people should live? Why are they in Eastern Europe? Because God had dispersed his people because of their sin. And they're there. And in this century, they're here in Asia. One of the cities that these seven churches were in, they found a massive synagogue at the center of town, which just doesn't happen. The synagogues typically are out on the outside of town because they'd come later, the Jewish population. What does that tell us? It tells us that the Jewish population had a large number, they were influential, and had a lot of, they're influential and had a lot of influence. That's kind of redundant. They had a lot of influence. And in this city, there was what Jesus refers to as a synagogue of Satan, a group of Jewish people that were attacking the Christians. Why does he call them a synagogue of Satan? One of Satan's roles, one of his titles, is he is the accuser of the brethren. He is the accuser of the followers of Christ. What does he accuse us of? You think that someone dying on the cross for you and giving his life in your place is going to get you in good with God? No. You don't deserve that. You're not good enough for that. Nobody's good enough for that. What you need to do is you need to earn it. You need to work hard to get in good with God. Here these Jewish people were saying, the people of the way, the followers of Jesus Christ, they're spreading lies about God. They're saying that this Jewish carpenter was actually God and that he'd given his life on the cross and he died in our place so that we could be forgiven. As Jewish people, we know that the way to God is doing what? Keeping the Old Testament law. You need to be circumcised. You need to do this. You need to do that. And doing those things is going to get you in good with God. That's how you establish a relationship with God. These people are telling you lies. They don't know God. They're blaspheming God. They're dragging him down to our level. Don't listen to them. And Jesus says, I know there's a synagogue there. And Jesus says, I'll call it a synagogue of Satan because they're lying about you. They say that they're Jewish people. They are Jewish people by descent, but they're not Jewish people in their hearts. Their hearts were not circumcised. They no longer were God's people. Now, is God going to keep his promises to his people, the people of Israel? Absolutely, he will. But not because of their faithfulness, because of his. And he'll keep his promises. But these people who were Jews in their ethnicity and their descent were not truly Jewish people in God's eyes because they had rejected God's Son. And if you don't have the Son, you don't have the Father. So he says, I know that there's this group of people, the synagogue of Satan, and they claim to be something they're not, and they're liars, and they're attacking you. I will take care of them. In fact, what I'm going to do, and we don't know how this happened, we don't know when this happened, we're just told that it will happen. There'll come a moment where they'll come and they will bow down at your feet. What is the picture here? They will acknowledge that you are right, that you are true representatives of me. They will have to acknowledge that I, Jesus, love you as a church, that you're my bride. I'll make that happen. Again, I don't know how it happens. I don't know when it happened. We're not told. He just makes the promise that I will cause them to come and fall down at your feet and acknowledge that I have loved you. He says, I will fight for you. Verse 10, since you have kept my command to endure patiently, I also will keep you from the hour of trial that is going to come upon the whole world to test those who live on the earth. I will protect you. I know. I will provide. I will fight for you. I will protect you. You guys, you see any similarities in our job description here? I hope we can, gentlemen. It's our job to know our wife, to value her, to appreciate her. It's our job to provide. It's our job to protect. And it's our job to fight for her. Right? Not a whole lot of shaking heads. A lot of guys are like, I don't know if I signed up for this. Yeah, you did. Yes, you did. He says, I will protect you. He says, there's a time coming. There's a time coming where there's going to be an hour of trial that is going to come upon the whole earth to test those who live on the earth. Do we know that there's a time coming where God is going to let loose his wrath to judge this world? Are we aware of that? Are we aware and are we appreciative that God is holding back his wrath right now? Not just on the earth, but on us as sinners saved by grace? No? The wages of sin is death. What do I deserve? I deserve death. I deserve to be separated from God because of my nature and because of my choices. I stand here before you. I exist. I'm not facing that judgment solely because of the patient, long-suffering kindness and grace of God. Period. Absolutely period. Peter tells us that God's not slack in keeping his promise. He's just patient. He wants every man to come to the truth, every woman, every teenager, to come to the truth and know that that cross was for them. That's why he died. We need to keep in the forefront of our mind, there's a time coming where God's going to say, okay, that's it. In his perfect time, he will say, that's it. And now this world that I created that has been living in rebellion to me is going to face my wrath. Where do we find that? We find it in Ezekiel, we find it in Daniel, and we find it in the rest of this book. Why aren't we looking at the rest of this book? Because I'm a big chicken, okay? I'll just be straight up with you. Someday we will. I need to get some more things figured out about it. But it's listed right there for us. And I encourage you to read it. It paints a very, very gruesome picture, graphic picture of God saying, that's it. Now you face my wrath. And Jesus says to this church, his bride, he says, that hour's coming and it's going to test the whole world, but I'm going to protect you from it. I'm going to protect you from it. Now, I know there's differences of opinions of when that happens. We use the word rapture to describe the moment where God takes his bride up into heaven. Some say it happened, there's a 7-year period described in Revelation of God's executing of his judgment, his wrath. Some say that'll happen at the beginning of the 7 years. Some say it'll happen in the middle. Some say it happens somewhere in there before his wrath is fully poured out on the earth. His bride will be taken away. I'm not here to argue pre-mid, post, pre-whatever. Okay? We don't have time for that. But we can say with absolute confidence, whenever that moment happens, Jesus will be faithful to his bride to protect his bride from that time of wrath. Now, I can say that confidently because it says right here, I will also. Why? Because you have kept my commandments. You've endured patiently. I love you. I will also keep you from the hour of trial that is going to come upon the whole world to test those who live on the earth. He will protect them. He will protect us. And then verse 11, he says, I am coming. When is he coming? What? Soon. He said, come on, it's been 2,000 years since it's been written. What's up with God and his soon thing? His time is not our time. And if you've lived any time on this planet, you already know that, right? That your timetable and God's timetable are different. When do we want something to happen? Now, I'm on my way to work this morning, coming into the church, and I go to Starbucks. And, I don't know, it might have taken 3 minutes, maybe. But you know what was in my head. Why is that car in front of me? How many drinks did they order? You know, how come that the hand keeps coming out and more stuff? And then here's the worst, just the most aggravating, is when the cup goes back in. You know, you've been there, right? The cup comes out, you finally, oh, it's going back in. No, you know, and then it comes out again, and you know, and then the little free card comes out. You know, we messed up, and you get the, you know, it's like what, 3 minutes, 4 minutes? I want my tea now. I know, judge me if you want, but I want it now. My timetable and God's timetable is not the same. His idea of soon is different than my idea. But I can tell you this with absolute confidence. His timing is perfect. His timing is absolutely perfect. When he chooses to, when the Father says, all right, go get your bride, it's time. That will be the absolute perfect time. It'll be the just time. It'll be the holy time. It will be the loving time. It will be the perfect time. The thing that we hold on to is he says, I am coming. I am coming for you. And that's the fifth point. I'm coming. He's coming for his bride. I will come for you. One of the saddest stories, events, and we've made movies about it, is when one, either the groom or the bride doesn't show up at the wedding ceremony. Now, hopefully nobody here, sitting here, has been in that moment where they've been left at the altar. That's a pretty big deal. When you walk up there, when you're the guy and you walk out and you stand up here next to the goofy preacher guy and you're standing here and you look down, you know, I've been there where I look over, there's a little bit of panic, a little bit of uncertainty. When the door's open, oh, she's here. Okay, good. You know, please come. I'm going to meet you here at this altar and we're going to make our commitments to each other. We really expect that person to be there. And being there communicates our love and appreciation, our commitment to that person. Jesus says, I'm coming. I will come for you. I will take you to my house, and we will have a feast. There will be a marriage feast celebration, and you will be my bride. Why? Because I love you. I love you, and I will come for you. I'm coming soon. Verse 11, middle of verse 11. So what does it look like to be victorious? He tells us, what does he want from his bride? Hold on. Pure and simple. Hold on. Hold on to what you have so that no one will take your crown. How do I earn and how do I keep my crown? We looked at that a couple of weeks ago. It's based on my life and how I choose to use what God has given me. Right? How I serve. Whatever he's given me. Talents, resources, time, abilities. I take those talents and I use them to build his kingdom, to make disciples. And one day I'll stand before him and he'll say, good job. Good job, Matt. You did what I wanted you to do with what I gave you. And Matt's going to get a crown for that. Paul talked about it in 2 Timothy chapter 4. I've finished my race. I've kept the faith. I've fought the fight. And now I'm coming to the end and now there's a crown waiting for me. Why? As we talked about it, he finished strong. He held on to the end. Jesus says, what I want from you, my bride, is I want you to hold on. I want you to hang on to what you have. You keep doing what I've called you to do. You keep being faithful to obey my word. You keep being faithful not to deny my name. And you do it right there where I've placed you. That's what it looks like to be victorious. You hold on. You hold on to what you have. You keep doing what you've been doing, you faithful church. Hold on to what you have so that no one will take away your crown. Can I lose my crown? I can. Paul talks about it. He says, man, and listen to this imagery. He says, I beat my body into subjection. He gives us the picture of the athlete who has to be incredibly disciplined on an Olympic level. That's hard for me to even comprehend how difficult that is to be in Olympics and the discipline that is required. He talks about the patient farmer who waters and weeds and fertilizes and waits. How long? All the way to the end, all the way to the harvest. And then he actually has to work to harvest the fruit. He gives the picture of the soldier. How long do we expect you to fight faithfully as a soldier in the battle? To what? Till the end, till it's over, till you've won or lost. You don't, you know, ching, 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 ching. Oh, man, I got to be at Starbucks. Ching, I'm done. You know, ching, and I walk away. It'd be ridiculous. All of these pictures paint the same scenario. You keep being faithful all the way to the end. Paul says, I beat my body into subjection so that I don't disqualify myself for the prize. I can serve God faithfully for 20 years and then allow myself to get off track and go pursue sin and disobedience to God, and I've disqualified myself. I've lost. Do I lose my salvation? Does God kick me out of his family? No, Paul talks about that in Corinthians 2. You're going to go through a car wash. Instead of water, it's going to be fire. And it's going to burn away everything that's impure and your motors are wrong. And some of us are going to come out, you know, you're sitting, going through the car wash and everything's being burned up. And when you get to the end, you're going to be standing there bare naked. And you got nothing to show for your life. Others will come through, it says, with jewels and gold and silver, precious things that survive the fire. And those are what I give to God. This is what I did with my life, and I received my reward. He says, hold on. Hold on. Don't let anybody take your crown. Don't give up. Don't quit. Don't buy into what you're being told. Don't listen to these lies. Hold on. And this is what he's going to do. Hold on to what you have so that no one can take your crown. Him, to the person who overcomes, the person that holds on, is victorious. I will make them a pillar in the temple of my God, and never again will he leave it. I believe the picture here to this church in Philadelphia, what we know from history is that after this series of earthquakes, the majority of the population of the city wouldn't live in the city anymore. They would go into the city to work, and these villages cropped up around the city because they were afraid to go back in. So every day was a drive, a camel ride or a walk back into the city, do your job, and then a commute back to your house. That was their life. And I love the picture here where he says, I'm going to make you a pillar in the temple, and you'll never leave it. Now, the New Jerusalem doesn't have a temple. The picture here of a temple is not of a building that we would think of as a building. In the New Jerusalem, what is the temple? Who is the temple? It's Jesus. What does the temple represent? The temple represents the very presence of God. That's where God comes. That's where he meets with his faithful followers. That's where he shows up to interact with them, to challenge them, encourage them, rebuke them, whatever needs to happen. You come to the temple to meet God. The picture here is it says you're going to be a temple or a pillar, secure. Nothing can change that in my presence, and you will never, ever have to leave it. That's what comes to the one who is victorious. I will make them a pillar in the temple of my God. Never again will he leave it. I will write on him, if you've been here through this series, this idea of writing names comes up several times. This is the biggest description in all these seven letters. I will write on him the name of my God. I am. It's kind of like the family name. And I don't mean that disrespectfully. I mean that with all respect. You're part of God's family. You're given the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which is coming down out of heaven from my God. I'm a citizen of that city. I belong there. The door is open to me. I am a Jerusalemite, if you will, of the new city. I'm his bride. It's the home that he's prepared for his bride. And that's where I get to live with him. And I will also write on him my new name. Let me close with this, because I want you to get this last name. Revelation chapter 19. Will you turn with me real quick, and then I'm going to turn our attention to the table, and John is going to come up. And he's going to direct us this morning as we remember our Savior. Revelation chapter 19, verse 12. I want to close with this. Let me start with verse 11. I saw heaven standing open, and there before me was a white horse, whose rider is called Faithful and True. We just saw that title in our text. With justice he judges and makes war. His eyes are like blazing fire, and on his head are many crowns. He has a name written on him that no one knows but he himself. The picture back in Revelation chapter 3, I will also write on him my new name. We don't even know what that is. We talked before about us getting a new name, right? Kurt the Chubby, I think, was the one that we settled for me. You know, I'm going to get this new name that God will give me as he sees me. Part of that, it's connected to Jesus putting on me his stamp. His name. When my wife and I got married 27 years ago, I know this is old-fashioned, but it is what it is. We stood up here in this very spot right here. We made vows to each other, and when the wedding ceremony was over, her name was Rebecca Allen. When she walked out of here, her name was Rebecca Pearson. I gave her my name. We have the same name. That's significant. We have the same name. We are one flesh. We are joined together, and our name is shared. Jesus says to the one who overcomes, you have my name. I will put my name on you. He who has an ear, listen to what the Spirit says to the churches. We're going to remember Christ this morning. He who has an ear, listen to what the Spirit says. Listen to what God is saying this morning. Whatever it is that He's calling you to, know this, that He loves you. If you're part of His bride, a part of His body, His church, He loves you. If you're not a part of His bride, He loves you. He wants you to become a part of His family. He's already provided the way for that to happen. Come to Him this morning. Come to Him this morning. He who has an ear, listen to what the Spirit says to the churches. Father, open up our eyes. Open up the eyes of our heart to truly see You this morning. As John leads us, I pray, God, that our eyes and our hearts would be drawn through Your Spirit to really see clearly what we are remembering this morning, how deep Your love for us really is. I thank You for this love letter, for this story. I thank You, God, for sending Your Son. Jesus, I worship You for loving Your church and for giving us Your name. It's in Your name that we come before God the Father this morning. Amen.